nice to see everybody here this afternoon. These are great times in DC. Baseball team won yesterday, the Caps won yesterday, the Wizards won last night. Trade Boston's are out. It is, first day of the season. Congress is out of session, it's wonderful. I'm Steve Chaney, I'm the CEO of the American Security Project. First, let me give some thanks to Paul Hamill, but Paul just ran out on me. He helped set this up, and I know he knows Sir Martin, and I'm very appreciative for what he did. And Matthew Wallen, who's running around in the back taking pictures, is our fellow for public diplomacy. And this is a new kind of area for ASP, and we're glad to have Matthew here working on it. We just pointed out there's our Wi-Fi, there's our hashtag. It is on the record. We are going to tape it. We'll have it up on our website late this afternoon or tonight. Let me lay out some quick ground rules. I'm going to talk for just a minute or two, then introduce Nelson Cunningham on our board, and he will introduce Sir Martin. You're welcome to talk as long as you want. And then when he's done, we'll take this down and we'll have a collegial little talk. I'll open it up to Q&A. Some ground rules on Q&A. This is a small room. We don't have a roving mic. I'll choose who's going to ask the question. You can stand up, speak loudly, have a short question, state your name and affiliation, and I'll repeat these when we get to that point. Let me talk for a second about the American Security Project, founded by Senators Kerry, Hagel, Hart, and Rudman, names I'm sure you're familiar with. We take on topical issues from a national security perspective, and we've built our board that way. It's bipartisan, with a strong national security component. We're very, very proud of our board. General Lester Lyles is now the chairman of USAA. He's on our board. Governor Whitman is now helping work with a nonprofit that's establishing standards for fracking, so we're excited about that. And not the least of which is Nelson Cunningham, who was named president of McLarty Associates. So now we have a current Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and President on our board. So we're very excited about that. But on to today's business, which is going to talk about branding, global politics, and public diplomacy. And I'll just a short story about branding, and I was telling Sir Martin about this earlier. If you're not familiar with Marines, shame on you for starters, but I think you probably remember slogans like the few, the proud, the Marines, we didn't promise you a rose garden. Those were all invented by a company called J. Walter Thompson. And the Marines have had a relationship with them for 40 plus years, maybe more. Now, when I became a general and was assigned as commanding general at Parris Island, I got into the recruiting business there and recruited the Marines for the United States. They send you to J. Walter Thompson School. And so you learn their branding or their side of branding and how they work that in their media relationships. I point that out to you because J. Walter Thompson is owned by this man. So I think Sir Martin knows a bit about branding for sure, and he'll certainly relay that to us today. So I'm pleased to have him there. And with that, let me introduce Nelson Cunningham from our board of directors. Nelson.
Well, thanks very much, Steve. I can't tell you how proud I am of the service that I have here on ASP's board. I was one of the original founding board members, and I look around and think about the people who sat around that table at our first board meeting. There was Secretary of State John Kerry, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, there was Undersecretary for International Affairs at Treasury Lael Brainard, there was U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Susan Rice, there was former Counsel to the President Greg Craig. I ask myself, what have I done wrong? It's a great organization, and it really was a testament to then-Senator Kerry's vision after the 2004 elections that we needed to get back to a place where foreign policy wasn't a partisan football, but was instead something where you could find common ground on both sides. And I've been very proud with this organization to help work to build a board that, as Steve outlined, is really it's one-third Democrats, one-third Republicans, and one-third retired flag officers who are who provide us the concrete foundation upon which those of us in the political world can try to come together and find common solutions on critical national security issues. And I'm very proud of the work that we've done across a whole host of issues. This public diplomacy series which we have takes us into a bit of a different place. It's one where I was fascinated. I actually didn't know the J. Walter Thompson piece until you just laid that out, Steve. I was going to say that the advertising world and the public diplomacy world maybe didn't have a lot to do with national security, but maybe actually it has everything to do with national security. Because when you think about it, it is in my business, traveling the world, many of you also think about international affairs deeply. You know, when you think about, China is rising, India is rising, Brazil is on the brink, Russia is in trouble. You ask yourselves, how do we form our perceptions of these countries? How do we know who's rising? How do we know who's falling? Where do we get that sense? I think what we're about to hear today is that this isn't just part of government sort of informally trying to influence how they're viewed in the world, but maybe the way that governments more formally try to establish their profiles in the world and to brand themselves, and to use a crass commercial term, to brand themselves, and to try to sort of use their attributes to help create an image in the mind of the public that helps those countries carry out their national goals, whether it's a small country like Singapore, a giant country like China, or a small but vibrant trading power like Chile. And we have here to help us today to discuss this topic, I think without a doubt, the world's greatest mind when it comes to thinking about public affairs.
You will go far.
Well, should I just stop right there? I'll just stop right there.
My mother would be so proud.
No, but you all know how lucky we here at ASP are, and all of us in this room, to be able to have Sir Martin here with us. WPP, the company that he founded in 1985, today has 165,000 employees around the world. They have 3,000 offices in 110 countries. They advise, it's almost ridiculous, all 30 of the Dow, of the top Dow 30, who knows how many of the Fortune 500, he knows. But he is, and they own many of the world's great public relations brands, including many of Washington's great brands, Hilton Knowlton, Burson, Marsteller, and a whole host of others. This is one of the people in the world who both knows best how companies choose to present themselves to the world, but also how countries choose to present themselves to the world. And he's here to help us understand today exactly how public diplomacy, nation branding, country branding all come together in today's modern world. Please put your hands together and join me in thanking Sir Martin for joining us today.
Thanks, General. Steve, and Nelson. A couple of observations, actually, what Nelson just said. Firstly, China's not rising, it's risen. So I just want to, but we have this horrible phrase in the West, partly because we don't want China to succeed, I think. I think certainly that's true of, to some extent, the US, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Spain. I mean, we feel we're in an unenviable position that we may be in the process of being eclipsed. I don't think America is, and we can come back to that if anybody wants to talk about that later, but I think it's always dangerous to underestimate America just now. You've only got to look at that CIA report that's prepared for the president every 4 years, the question being, what's America going to look like in 20 years? And the answer came back to a re-elected President Obama, that in the next 20 years, America will be energy self-sufficient, and therefore Saudi Arabia will be China and India's problem, not America's. And secondly, if you look at some of the manufacturing developments like 3D printing and similar techniques, American manufacturing might be much more dominant than people give it credit for. So never underestimate America. But China's risen. I mean, you've got to remember that China is now the second largest economic power, having eclipsed Japan. Depending on which measure you look at, a year or so ago, certainly in advertising, it's the second largest market. And if you look at the world's economy, it's 72 trillion or thereabouts of GNP, and US is about 16 trillion and China's about 8.5. And so you've really got to remember that, I think. So that's one thing. And the second thing, you said you use a crass phrase like branding. Branding to me is not crass. Right? Branding, you're right on, whatever the right American way of expressing it. You know, to talk about branding is absolutely critical. And understanding that, you know, I was just looking at the risk of losing my notes, I was looking at what we're doing currently. So in our latest The Wire, which is our internal newspaper, both traditional legacy newspaper and new newspaper, digital. We're working on India, we're working on Aruba, we're working on Mexico, we're working on South Africa, we're working on Qatar, we're working on USA, on brand USA, we're working on Melbourne, we're working on Hong Kong. Now there are others, but those are some of those that we highlighted just in our thing. So government spending, there is two things I think really to think about. First of all, what we're talking about, country branding or city branding, is a subset of what I would call government spending. And if you looked at WPP's results in the last 2-3 quarters, the segment of our business that has been growing the fastest, you would never believe it, given the pressure on government spending in various parts of the world. But the segment that's growing fastest is government spending. So if I looked at our last three quarters, actually, so it's the last three quarters of calendar 2012, government spending was growing the fastest at a time when you would think the reverse was the case. And in many countries, the government in all its forms, and we cover not just advertising, we cover advertising, we cover media, what we call media investment management, which is media planning and buying. We cover consumer insight, which is market research, public relations and public affairs, branding and identity, healthcare, communications, and digital, basically. So it's aspects of government spending that covers that. But you have to remember, you know, if I gave you the view of WPP of the world and how the world's changing from a marketing perspective, I've come up with about 9 or 10 things that we see happening. One of the biggest things we see happening is a maintenance of government involvement. But if you looked at the precedent for what's happening today, the nearest precedent historically would be the Great Depression of 1929. And government involvement as regulator, investor, intervener, stimulator, communicator, in the 30s continued really at a very, very high levels, at least until World War II. And then, of course, in the context of the World War, government became an even more important player. But government, you know, the message would be government is here to stay generally. And then we'll move into now the subset of that, which is country branding. Now, it's been phrased as country branding, I think, and I want to just modify it a little bit. You know, all good agencies ignore the brief. I won't be deterred from ignoring the brief. In one sense, this is not just about country branding, it's about city branding. So, one of our agencies at Ogilvy does a campaign, or has been doing a campaign for IBM for many years, which started as Smarter Planet, and has been honed or refined to Smarter City. Now, why is that? Well, 50% of the world's population, the 6.5 billion, already live in cities. I think the prognosis is that by 2030, I think it is, 70% of the world's population will be living in cities. So country branding, the positioning of countries, has become, or will become, an even more important phenomenon. It's how you position a country and how you position a city-state. I mean, Nelson mentioned Singapore, and I'll come back to Singapore because I think it is one of the paragons of virtue in terms of branding, and I'll come back to the structural issue, which I think is the heart of the issue. The heart of the issue is not that people fail to understand the importance of crass branding. They do understand that. What they don't understand is how to implement it. It's about strategy and it's about structure. It's about implementation, and that's where people fall down. But let me just make one or two observations about country branding and to some extent city branding, remembering that city branding is critically important. Now, we work with the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. We work with the Mayor of Rome, Mirella Mano. In 2 weeks' time, I'm going to Jerusalem to work with the Mayor of Jerusalem. We put together, we take the, actually it's very interesting, we take the Chinese experience. I'm deputy chairman of the Mayor of Shanghai's board. It's called IBLAC, International Business Leaders Advisory Council. Very pretentious title, but really interesting. For 20 years, the Mayor of Shanghai, more than 20 years, the Mayor of Shanghai, and indeed the Mayor of Beijing, I think for a similar period, have invited CEOs of major corporations to come and advise them one day a year. So you go, we have an afternoon where we do usually an environmental act, you know, releasing sturgeon into the river, planting a tree, releasing birds. My bird actually limped, limped away from me, didn't fly away from me. It was a bit dispiriting, but he was okay. He or she was okay. But we do an environmental thing. We have a dinner with the Communist Party Secretary of Shanghai and the mayor. And then the following day, we have previously been given a subject. It could be an environmental subject, whatever. Education, infrastructure, traffic, congestion, whatever it is. And we do a paper, a lengthy paper, which is translated meticulously into Chinese for the bureaucracy. And they pick about out of the 55 CEOs, and by the way, they insist it's the CEO of the worldwide company. They won't take regionals or regional presidents. It has to be, and you have to attend every year. And if you don't attend every year, you're off. And they pick about 5 or 10 of the CEOs to make presentations. They choose them each year from the group. And you make a presentation, brief presentation to the bureaucracy, usually about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes in length. And of course, the Chinese have this horrible habit of listening, you know, which we've forgotten about the West, and learning. And when you run, and they don't fall asleep. And most of you will be asleep by the time I've finished. They don't fall asleep. They sit there rigorously. So I use it as an example. So we're doing that with Boris Johnson in London, doing that with Alemano in Rome, and we're going to do it with the Mayor of Jerusalem, and indeed we're going to go into Ramallah as well to look at the other side of the equation, the equal equation. So I use those examples because these are people who understand, you know, the importance of branding in a city context. So let me just make a few observations very quickly and then come back to the structural issue and then we can open up for Q&A. The first is observation is that subtlety is extremely important. Subtlety works. It's interesting that, you know, the Japanese have come out with a Cool Japan program recently, which mirrors what the British did with Cool Britannia under Tony Blair's government, you know, which was, it was seen as really, it was done in 1997, it was seen as being too hokey, really, too sort of folksy, and that was probably a little bit crass, actually. But what's worked actually much, much better recently is this Great Britain campaign. Now, unfortunately, it's not been funded, I think, to the degree that it should be, and I was at the launching here at the, here in the United States of it, the US element of it, a year or so ago with Mayor Bloomberg and with the Prime Minister, with David Cameron, and there was a great discussion as to what the investment should be. But it's the Great Britain campaign, and what's really interesting, and this is really fundamental and very important, the reason that campaign has been, I think, successful is, number one, the branding has been good. In using the Great Britain, we can argue whether Britain is great or not, but we've got great entrepreneurs, great innovation, great tourism, whatever it is, but it has a common theme running across all government departments. No government department can propagate itself or communicate without using the template. And this, you know, this rigid, what may seem to some to be rigidity is absolutely fundamental. So what little you see in the campaign, and there should be more, I think, it should be invested in more, what little you see is perfectly coordinated. And every minister knows that, and every civil servant knows that when they communicate, they have to use the template. So subtlety works. Subtlety, the cool Japanese one, we have an internal award scheme for WPP for the best published work
externally. And Christopher Graves, who runs Ogilvy Public Relations worldwide, was the winning, the Grand Prix entry. There are different sort of segments depending on whether it's public relations or design, but his in the public relations, branding and identity area was on Cool Japan, the Cool Japanese campaign, which we think is a little bit, again, sort of mirroring some of the mistakes of Cool Britannia, but his was the winning entry, and he goes into exhaustive detail, actually, of how the Japanese have attempted to do it and how they may have done it not quite the right way. So that's the first point about subtlety. The second point is that companies and products, ironically, may be the most powerful branding drivers for countries. So the efficiency and reliability of a BMW or of a Mercedes-Benz tells more about it, or VW actually. You know, VW is probably now the largest automobile fan manufacturer worldwide. Tells more about Germany than money the country could spend on a branding campaign. So to some extent, what you do at a government level or at a student level is negated by what the images are of products. So for example, you know, French Hermès scarves and the French sense of style is dictated by their, you know, a company like LVMH, which is one of the most successful branding companies in the world in the luxury area. Obviously, it determines what people think about France. For the US, what do you think about when you think about the US? You think about Coca-Cola, you think about McDonald's, good or bad. You might think about other fast food companies and restaurants as well, but then again, the image of America is fashioned by that. And there's a danger that some countries might be too tied to single companies. I mean, if you look at the challenges that Nokia is facing, and think about how that conditions people to thinking about Finland. You know, it was wonderful when Nokia was soaring, but obviously when Nokia is much more challenged, it comes under pressure. So to some extent, what you do is outside your control because it depends on the success of major companies. Now, the reverse of that is that a poor reputation can hurt commercial interests. I mean, a very interesting business school study, IMB, found out that 43% of Americans said they'd be less likely to buy a computer from a Chinese-owned Lenovo, despite the fact that it was the same product that IBM had marketed successfully for years. Now, we were talking a little bit about that, and that might be for irrational reasons, that might be for sort of racist reasons in a sense, or chauvinistic reasons, but it does show you that reputation, you know, what a country stands for, if you brand it, in this case Chinese, that it might have a negative consequence for political reasons, irrational reasons, emotional reasons, as well as factual reasons. So that's the third point. Poor reputation can hurt you as well. The fourth point is that culture does matter an awful lot. And this, I think, is a fascinating little case study, not one that we did. In 1984, the Australian Tourism Commission commissioned a series of television advertisements to promote American visits to Australia, and they used Paul Hogan, who was unknown in the US, Crocodile Dundee, you may remember him, in the US, saying that he would, quote, I won't imitate his accent, slip an extra shrimp on the barbie for you, unquote. Even though the Australians use the word prawn, they don't use the word shrimp. If you use prawns in America, you probably wouldn't have got anywhere at that time. And instead of shrimp, and shrimp consumption is much higher in the US than in Australia. The advertising premiered in the NFL conference championship game in January of 1984. And before the campaign, Australia was number 78 on the most desired vacation destination list for all Americans, and became number 7, so from 78 to 7, within 3 months after the launch. And when Hogan became famous in 1986 with the movie Crocodile Dundee, Australia soon became the number 1 or 2 on Americans' dream vacation list, remaining in that position for most of the next 2 decades. So it shows you, you know, how branding, personalities, celebrity is very important actually in the context of all this, can build and change impressions. Having said that, although culture might mean an awful lot, it's also true that good branding builds on truth. I mean, you can only sell a bad product once, even politically, I would argue that's the case. You can probably get away with it once, but you can't get away with it twice. And good examples of that, in Slovenia and Croatia, effectively, which are wonderful tourist destinations, were extremely effective in highlighting their scenic tourist locations and became hot destinations just a few years after being involved in the first European war in half a century. So it is possible, where you have a good product, or it is essential to have a good product and build on those truths. And poor branding, the converse of that, tries to convince people of an untenable reality. So good example of the untenable reality was the campaign for Georgia. After Georgia was routed by its war with Russia, the government launched a campaign where the tagline was, "The winner is Georgia," would you believe? And the campaign attempted to show it was a better place to visit and do business than nations such as France or indeed China, but ignoring its loss on the battlefield. I won't tell you which agency was responsible for that, but it was one of our competitors. So don't try and brand something that is poor. You know, the truth will win out. And the final point before I come on to what I think is the heart of it is the best branding is good policy. So just as it's difficult for ads, whether they're online or offline, to overcome poor products, national branding has a hard time overcoming poor policies. And America has been best, I'll take America as an example, has been best regarded around the world when public policies, be they going back in time, say the Berlin airlift, or the response to a tsunami in Asia, have shown the best aspects of what makes America a great nation. So that gives you some thoughts. Let me just come to what I think is the heart of the issue. And this is really becoming more and more important. Because in a world where, you know, companies actually are nation states, and companies can shift, and this is, you know, this is contentious stuff and this is controversial stuff, because companies can shift their location now. You know, we moved and were criticized for moving from London to Dublin. We've since moved back to London, to the UK. We were worried about the Labour administration imposing a tax on overseas earnings, whether remitted or not. We operate on a remittance basis. So if we leave money outside the UK, unremitted, we would pay obviously local tax. But the threat was that we would be taxed overseas, whether we were taxed on the overseas earnings, the UK tax rate, so double tax effectively, even if we left it abroad. It was called controlled foreign corporation legislation. The new government, the coalition government between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, gave us an assurance with legislation and other companies that that will be not will be the case, and we move back. So the point I'm making is that the companies make investment decisions increasingly on where the best place is to locate. So country branding or city branding involves the globalization of companies, tax, spending, infrastructure, education, technology, all the issues that worry the president of this country, the prime minister of my country, my national country, all those things are critically important in terms of country branding, city branding, and location. And if I was looking, Nelson mentioned, you know, Singapore. If I was looking for the two best examples of branding, the two countries at the opposite ends of the spectrum that I think get it right, I would certainly pick Singapore. 5.3 million people, 40% of which, by the way, are foreigners. And the big domestic issue in Singapore, big political issue, is when that figure goes above 50%. Because obviously, if you have a large population from outside, from wherever they come, and the impact that they have on housing, education, infrastructure, etc., is critically important. But I would choose Singapore as the best example. Now, people would say it's a very autocratic country, very highly governed, you know, no chewing gum on the pavement. That's probably the most extreme example of it. But having said that, it works extremely effectively. and all the policies there are linked together. We work very closely with the EDB, the Economic Development Board. We have 3,000 people in Singapore. I think the largest employer there is Seagate with about 5,000 people. We are certainly in the top 5, 6, 7 companies in terms of the number of people we have. It's a regional hub. It's becoming more and more popular, not just because of low taxation, but because of technology. It's well-wired because of education, because of communications, infrastructure, both hard and soft infrastructure. You know, get to the airport within 15 to 20 minutes and it works. But it's on a small scale. At the opposite end of the spectrum, and you may not like what I'm going to say, but I do think China gets it right too. Now, for example, if you go to Davos and you speak to any of the Chinese delegations there, it's almost as though they have a little sort of mission statement in their pocket. They have 3 points, and they repeat it to you ad nauseum. They are very much on message, and it's extremely well coordinated, whether you're talking about SOEs, state-owned enterprises, or private companies. So if you ask me who are the best examples at the moment currently, who've got it all together, I would say those are two very good examples. There are others, but two very good examples. And let me just sort of come really to what I think is the heart of it. I won't say which government, but a recently elected presidential campaign that we worked on, it was at Davos. We met the candidate who ultimately won the presidential campaign. And he asked me, he said, what advice would you give me? And I'm not, despite the build-up that Nelson gave me, I'm certainly not the best brain on this by any means, but I do have some knowledge and experience of it. And I said to him, well, look, if you're going to, in terms of branding and branding this particular country, which has got bags of potential, has got realized success and bags of potential, I said, really, what you have to do is you have to pull it all together. The president or prime minister of a country is in exactly the same position, in my view, as the chairman and or CEO of a company. They are the brand guardians of that country. And now, the unfortunate thing about politics, I've been CEO for WPP for 28 years. The average CEO only lasts about 4.5 years, I'm told, in America. I think worldwide it's only 3 years. So actually it's got less than political tenure, actually, to it. And the problem with politics, of course, is you have to get elected, which increasingly is true for CEOs as well. You have to get elected. And those elections usually take place every 4 or 5 years, so it's quite difficult to have longevity. But I said to this guy who was a candidate at the time, pull it, you have to pull it together. You can't have different ministers going off with their ministries in different directions. So think back to the Great Britain campaign. Having that template of which ministers who have various political objectives and temporal political objectives, particularly when they get closer to an election, and they want to get messages out to the electorate, and they often use government budgets. You know, you can argue about the fairness of that to do it. Obviously, the opposition always complains about it. But pulling it all together structurally is the critical issue. You can't have people going off in different directions. If you're running the tourism budget, the investment budget, the education budget, the infrastructure budget, it all has to be coordinated. And I don't think governments get it. The interesting thing about cities is that mayors and governors of states, I think, actually get it, are increasingly getting it more and more. And it might be because of that statistic, you know, the IBM statistic that 70% of the world's population will be in cities in a very short period of time. And you're starting to see some really interesting things happen, particularly events. I'm on the board of Formula One, which is now private equity controlled, but it's one of three major sporting events, live sporting events, that have a critical impact on how people perceive countries or cities. Probably the biggest impact comes from either the Olympics, not so much the Winter Olympics, I think, but the Summer Olympics, and the World Cup. And the third one, I would say, will be Formula One. And you know, what happens in these cases is that countries or cities take these on because they see them as changing the impression. And good, you have to have a good product, to come back to the point about good product, but changing the impression that people have about a country or city. So let me give you concrete examples. Beijing You know, if China was rising pre-Beijing, post-Beijing it had risen. Beijing proved what the Chinese could do. The opening ceremonies and closing ceremonies, the opening ceremony in particular, and quite controversial in some respects, even within China, even I'm told within the Politburo. But when you looked at it, if you look at its technological capability, the scale on which they did, the creativity, it was quite extraordinary. And it changed the image that the world had, I think, of Beijing, of China, and of Asia. The World Cup, the Football World Cup in South Africa, quite controversial in the South African context, changed the image, I think, of South Africa, and more importantly, Africa on a world stage. And I would argue that the London Olympics, you know, everybody said, well, the British will mess this up. And we didn't. Rather, Sebastian Coe and his crew didn't. They did a fantastic job. And the opening ceremony, although it was quirky, although it was probably less flamboyant or certainly less expensive than Beijing, was, you know, uniquely, I think, British, very historical. It was one man's view of history, but Danny Boyle, who did Slumdog Millionaire and other films, was drafted in, and he did an extraordinary job. And again, that created an impression of Great Britain, Brand Britain, which I think was very different to what people expected. And the last thing I would say, you know, one of the areas of the world that we're very excited about, you know, we're just a few yards away from the Inter-American Development Bank run by Luis Moreno, he and I both believe that this is the decade of Latin America. I would argue that despite the infrastructure issues that Brazil faces with the World Cup next year, and it's only next year in 2014, and with the Olympics in Rio, which is a very, you know, running an Olympics is a very complex event, despite the challenges, my bet would be that the world's view of Brazil, of Rio, and more importantly, Latin America, will change positively as a result of what you see. All these things, what you see in the next year in the World Cup and in 2016 at the Rio Olympics, all these things have a massive impact on people's thinking. And if you take Formula One, I'll just end on Formula One, for example. It costs about $200 million to put on a Formula One event, to build a track, to build the infrastructure around it, etc. Why do countries do that? And it's interesting, if you look at the Formula One calendar, it's shifted from the old world to the new world. The new races are Shanghai and Singapore and Korea, South Korea. Those are where the new tracks, Bahrain, much more controversially. That's where the new tracks are being built. Why do people do it? Because they see it as altering the image, reputation, and branding of the country and positioning it as a more and more important destination. So I think, I hope that helps a little bit what we see in country branding. But I would just finally emphasize the issue of structure. Everybody focuses on strategy and the thinking bit. It's critically important, obviously, but it's no good having a strategy you don't implement. And the biggest problem, going back to that presidential candidate, which it's interesting, since he's become president of that particular country, he is integrating it quite heavily. So he has taken, I think, the advice to heart, but it's very difficult to do, particularly when you have coalition governments. Very tough, because coalitions are about compromise, and you, in country branding, you can't have compromise. You've got to have a strategy which you implement vigorously. Thank you very much.
Mr. Martin, great comments. We're going to have a slight reorganization up here. The message I take from this is the United States needs to do away with NASCAR and bring Formula One in, and that will resolve our...
Maybe a merger between Formula One and NASCAR.
Yeah, maybe. Yes.
That would be a good idea.
Before we open up Q&A, just one quick question for myself, stimulated by your comments that I'm amazed, as you were, I think, when you talk about the last two quarters, the increase in government spending has been the biggest increase in your sector. In this country, when they talk about foreign aid or foreign investment, and of course now we're into sequestration and all this kind of business, it seems like there is absolutely no interest to increase any money or budgeting into our branding aspect of it or into foreign aid. Or any part of that. Do you have any comment or thoughts about that in particular?
Well, I think you have to be very careful. I mean, you know, probably for me, I'm a foreigner in your land, and therefore it's invidious for me. This won't stop me from commenting. America, if you believe that, you know, a balanced budget or a more balanced budget, the less debt is the better route, ultimately, and that you can't kick the can down the road forever, that you have to face the reality of $16 trillion of debt. And that's what I believe. I mean, you can argue as to how extreme you have to be, whether it should be $4 trillion or whatever it is, Simpson-Bowles is the right thing or whatever it is, you can argue about that. But that means that America increasingly is going to have priorities. And that inevitably means that, you know, defense decisions, investment decisions, foreign aid decisions, increasingly you're going to have to prioritize this year. And that the time of plenty, you know, not gone, but, you know, we have to be more careful where we spend our money. And you know, there's a really interesting thing that I think from a foreign policy point of view that's been happening in the last few years, which I've noticed in the context of our business. You know, Africa and Latin America are increasingly important. In fact, Latin America was the fastest growing region last year, and my bet would be it will be the fastest growing region for us this year. And one third of our business comes from Asia, Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Central and Eastern Europe, the so-called BRICS, and next level, you know, Jim O'Neill's things. The Chinese have understood this for years. So whilst the West was focused on Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, China was sort of, in a way, attacking the soft underbelly of our foreign policy and priorities in Africa. 800,000 Chinese in Africa, you know, doing projects. You know, you go to Kenya. You know, I've gone to Nairobi on a Sunday and I've driven into Nairobi, and every bridge that I've gone under is being manufactured by a Chinese construction company on the highway. Latin America, you know, I'll give you a good example. When Santos was inaugurated as president after Uribe in Colombia, you mentioned Chile. I think Colombia is much more interesting country in the context of Latin American development. But I always remember, I went there for the inauguration to Bogota, and the British had one of our ministers, perfectly able, good guy there, and Santos in his inauguration speech said, I'm going to build a million houses because lower middle income people, families in Bogota or Colombia didn't have enough housing. Who did the Chinese have at the inauguration? The housing minister. So they think, you know, they think about these things much more intensely, and you know, we were talking about this a little bit before we the session. You know, you mentioned from your own experience how carefully they think about it. They really do think. They really do listen. They do go through the "or shucks" routine. You know, we don't really know. We're just learning. They really do plan and think very carefully. So I think, coming back to your question, I think America has to think in the same way, very carefully, just like the British actually. You know, we've had to reduce our defense spending, security spending, foreign aid. And foreign aid is one of the areas of the budget that hasn't been cut. You know, the austerity cuts have not, you know, foreign aid has been one of the things that Osborne, as Chancellor, Cameron, the Treasury Secretary, and the Prime Minister have said, if not sacrosanct, certainly is one of the areas that could happen. So I think, you know, America has to get used to that. Having said that, and I've got to underline, I'm very bullish on the United States. It's fashionable not to be, and it's fashionable to question it. I think it's very dangerous. I think when you think about oil and energy and shale, and you think about these improvements in manufacturing, if any of you have seen 3D printing, and you know, I'm just focusing on one technique, it is phenomenal what you can do, and it's on a very small scale now, but what we might be able to do from a manufacturing point of view with 3D printing in a manufacturing context. So this, to my mind, is like in the 80s where we said Japan was going to take over the world, or people said it was going to take over the world, and along came Ronald Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher, a bit in the context of whatever you think about it, made a difference. So I think be careful. I think America actually is in a much more powerful position than we give it credit for. Some people. Thank you.
All right, you remember my ground rules on asking a question. If you just raise a hand and I'll recognize you, and then if you could state your name and affiliation loudly so we can all hear it, we'll go ahead. Yes, sir, in the back.
Sir, my name is Pete Dillon. I'm the Marine Corps Fellow at the Atlantic Council. Talk briefly pointed out that what you're talking about is opinion shaping. Do you believe that you can shape extreme opinions that may have already had the root formed? So, for example, our target audience and our national efforts to sway opinions for those who might wish us ill. How do we do that?
Well, it is about hearts and minds. So, I mean, I don't think you can, it's like the old argument about can force win out alone? I mean, force cannot win out alone. Propaganda cannot win out alone in the same way. It is about hearts and minds. If, for example, you were thinking about how do you solve, what is the best way of solving, apart from military means, what is the best way of solving problems? It is through economic progress. What is the reason for the Arab Spring? What are the reasons? Youth unemployment, high food prices, lack of education, whatever the reasons are. So how could you have avoided those problems? It's by addressing and dealing with those issues. And this is about winning people's hearts and minds. I mean, the analogy to a commercial transaction, I think, is selling a bad product. You can't sell a bad product, I think, beyond one time. You might be able to fool somebody once, either at the, either in the supermarket or at the polls. But if the product doesn't fulfill the promise, you can't do it a second time. David Ogilvy famously said the consumer is not a moron. This is terribly politically incorrect in today's environment. The consumer is not a moron, it's my wife. So you would say, the consumer is not a moron, it's my partner now. But he's dead right. And you can't, you must credit consumers with a tremendous amount of intelligence. You can't fool them. So I think, to your question about it, it's really about hearts and minds. And you have to win the hearts and minds. And you said people who want to cause us ill, you've then got to try and look at the root causes of why it is that they wish us ill. And there will always be those sorts of people, and try and deal with those issues. And if I look at, for example, Israel and Palestine, a lot of the problems. And I went to the Vital Voices Awards last night, and there was this Palestinian woman who was one of the awards, and she is building a 40,000 unit housing development, lower income housing in Palestine, because she believes that there's not enough, she and her partner believe there is not enough housing for, it's all at the top end, or the middle end, it's not lower, middle, and lower. So, I look at that, I use that as just an example, it's top of my mind, because I saw that last night. I think that's a very good example of what is behind your question and the way you have to deal with it. You have to deal with the root causes of this. And the capitalist system, with all this, I mean, I'll just give you an interesting little story. So I went with Hank Paulson and seven other CEOs to the China Advanced Leadership Program, CALP, which is it's in Shanghai. It's a magnificent campus. It's what I call the Chinese Harvard Business School. And we had 2 days with the 40 chairmen and CEOs of what is known as SASAC. Now, SASAC is the government holding company which controls all of the state-owned enterprises, all the government-owned enterprises. And these companies have a combined turnover of $2.2 trillion.
mean, it's a bit of a cheat because the government might own 20%, so you're just consolidating all of it. And the last time I checked, about 2 or 3 years ago, that combined sales were about 1.79 trillion. It got up to about 2.2 trillion. And we sat and we talked to these CEOs for 2 days. And by the way, they listened. They didn't fall asleep. They took notes. No, not like when you're in London or, you know, they're all half asleep after 10 minutes. And they sat there for 2 days, all in their white shirts, short sleeve shirts. It reminded me a little bit of IBM in the 60s, but in a different way. And then we had a sort of private conversation with a dinner with several of the CEOs and from the Chinese side. and we said to them, you know, what is the biggest challenge you face? And they said, well, having the state as your sole shareholder is difficult because you have very little flexibility. You know, you need more entrepreneurial, I think they actually used the word entrepreneurial, flexibility. So there was that. Then I thought, what are we doing in the West? We're going the opposite direction. We're going towards more regulation, more intervention, and whatever the rights and wrongs are. And I'm not saying there aren't rights about, you know, corporate governance, executive pay, all the things that people are very focused on. But the irony was, they're looking, and they will get it, by the way. They will get more flexibility. They will move more to the sort of freedom, sort of economic freedom, whilst we're going the other way. So we're becoming more regulatory. And the danger is they'll be even more effective as a result of adopting more flexibility into their system. So just an example, I think, of something to see. So, but at the heart of it, you win the people's hearts and minds. Propaganda on its own will not work.
Another question, Mr. Earl, in the back.
Hey, sir, my name is Brian Salas. I'm with the Bold Eagle Group. It's one of the newest full-service communications companies here. I'll ask you to comment on what I call the Dennis Rodman effect and popular culture.
We owned a piece of Vice, so don't Google Vice, by the way. Google Vice.com. You Google Vice, God knows what you get. So we own 9% of Vice. But when you say comment on the Dennis Rodman phenomenon, what aspect?
The popular culture and the effect on the national brand and his recent visit to North Korea, and then how
the effect on who, though? North Korea? On
yes, sir.
Us?
On other on the export of American culture, popular culture from any country to other countries, and how does that affect policy?
I think it's rather nice that the North Korean supreme leader likes basketball and is engaged. Shane Smith, who runs Vice, told me, and I think it was premiered last night actually in New York on HBO. I think there's 18 hours of tape. I think it's 18 hours. I don't know whether everybody's going to sit there and watch 18 hours of tape. But it is sort of interesting. I mean, this was a Vice special. I mean, Vice had done what I would call extreme news acts, because they have several verticals: travel, news, music, films, everything. And obviously in the news area, Shane and Eddie Moretti, the creative director, have been quite aggressive. At the end of the day, I think it was an extraordinary event. We have seen other North Korean excursions. You know, Eric Schmidt made his trip with Bill Richardson. At the end of the day, I think it probably is a way of engagement, whether it's the best way of engagement with the North Korean regime or not, I don't know. We were talking a little bit about it. I was in South Korea last week, and I think actually, you know, there is a great degree of concern in South Korea, but I think probably we are more concerned about it, that was my sense, than they are. That they see the status quo as probably continuing, and low probability of anything extreme happening, either because they don't have the capability or because it's words and it's early stages in a new regime. Somebody said to me,
this is the third generation and the gene pool shows little signs of weakening. So, the Rodman thing, I think, it was a Vice news program, news effort.
Yes, ma'am, all the way back.
Hi, Lydia DePillis, The New Republic magazine. Do you have a sense of the implications of this next month, new top-level domains will be rolling out?
Sorry, come here.
So ICANN, the Internet Corporation, for
right.
Rolling out new top-level domains. They talk a lot about the expansion of the Internet and how the opportunities for speech and branding. There are many of your branding colleagues think this is going to be a terrible thing. What's your take for nations, for cities, for brands themselves?
Well, the growth of social communication and all positive. I mean, if it's a reality. So, it's a bit like commuting the waves. I mean, you're not going to be able to stop it. Regimes that thought they could stop it are increasingly going to be engulfed. So you have to, it's like running a company. Everything inside your company, you have to regard every written word you have to look at as though it was there on the internet. I mean, we see that all time, every time. So there is no, there is no opacity anymore. If you're running a city or you're running a country, you have to utilize, if you looked at the Obama campaign, what is the thing that really, to my mind, as a foreign eye looking at it, the Obama political machine, understood the importance of women, single women, Hispanics, Afro-Americans, the young, in a far more sophisticated way, I would say, than the Republican or Romney machine, political machine. They organized themselves extremely effectively. I remember talking to somebody on election day who said they'd just received a communication from the Democratic headquarters that said, we know you voted, but your sister in Ohio has not voted. I think he was in Alabama or somewhere. Could you call her and get her to vote? And, one of our agencies, Blue State Digital, were heavily involved in the fundraising campaigns, both times for the Obama thing. So we've seen social communication at work. The Orca the Orca software, as I understand it, which Romney was using, broke down on election day. So understanding the implications of it, and by the way, in this morning's papers or yesterday's papers, we've seen that the EU is moving in a concerted way on the privacy issues that Google have, and we're going to see more of that. I mean, this is the first time that I think the privacy issue, has affected Google, I think, in a more conservative way. I mean, it's a little bit of a change, and I think the EU is probably taking a slightly different approach, a more vigorous approach, it appears, and it's very concerted between, I think, four or five countries in the EU on the privacy issue. And so, the governments will be concerned about some of the areas, like privacy. But generally, I mean, you would be like commuting the waves you ignored this stuff.
I hate to interrupt. I just meant more specifically the top-level domain. So like .nyc, .verizon. There's a lot of concern about fraud, about all of these new ones being available in the next year or so.
Yeah, well, okay, let me ask you this. What's the alternative? You restrict it? Okay, so you restrict it, but it doesn't mean that you're going to limit its power. And if you're talking about it in the context of country and city branding, these are much more affordable techniques. The absolute levels of spending, because of the audiences are much more fragmented, the absolute levels of spending are very much lower, and they're very much more personalized. And you can measure them more easily. A large part of our business is in audience measurement, both legacy media and new media. So I would argue that there are risks, whether it's privacy, whether it's the naming risk that you mentioned, or whatever, and the fraud risk. I mean, cyber security is you know, probably the number one issue, or close to the number one issue that we all have to deal with in companies now. And you've seen the cyber attacks in the last few weeks and the prevalence of them. So there are problems that come with these techniques, but in terms of, if I'm trying to run a city or a country, I think this gives me tremendous power to reach every person in the population on a personalized basis, which is a technique that we never had before. And it supplements.
I think we can take one more, and this young lady right here.
Hi, my name is Ashley Chase. I'm an associate at the Scowcroft. And I'm interested in your comment that the best branding is based off of good policy. So
I didn't say the best. I said it should be part of it.
It should be part of it. So I'm interested to see how your organization confronts, let's say, poor policies, and clients hired in a prominent case might be, and this is individual, Uhuru Kenyatta, who just won the election in Kenya, you know, hiring a UK lawyer to help him face the ICC, and how you sort of walk the line between maybe an ethical or moral obligation to advise them on a specific policy that might be at odds with what they actually want to do.
Yeah. It's a bit off country branding and the subject matter, but I'll have a go. Won't stop me. No, I think it's a matter of decision and judgment. You know, I mean, everything now is, you know, I get myself into hot water in the UK for saying that, you know, the level of corporation tax that you pay, not you pay the corporation, but it's a matter of judgment. It's a sort of moral decision, in the sense that if you're running a multinational company, you know, it's not you can decide what, but, you know, by locating your operation. I mean, for example, you don't have to move out of London to Dublin to alter the corporation tax that you pay. You can sit in London, and you can move your procurement department to Switzerland or your branding department to Ireland, and you don't have to really change the locus, or certainly the domicile. So a lot of the areas in which we operate in, because of the globalization of a business, particularly corporations, is a matter of judgment. So the question you're asking about, you know, who you represent, who you work for, what you do, is a question of judgment. And, you know, some people have different, you know, taking the analogy to tax, some people say, I'm not going to pay any tax, and set up there, and perfectly legally, not evasion, avoidance, okay? So they're totally within the law. But now, in the environment in which we operate in, people are taking a different attitude. They're saying, whatever the law is, you know, given the difficulties that economists face, the austerity, you know, 50% youth unemployment in Spain, 50%. The general levels of unemployment of 15 to 20, but 50% youth unemployment, one in two people can't find jobs. You know, there's something more fundamental at work here. So I liken it to you, to the question you've asked, because I think it's a question of judgment. So whether if you're the UK lawyer who decides to represent Kenya, who's been elected by the country, right? So as the leader of the country, now we'll see how his war crimes, you know, what happens in terms of his trial. But I think it's a question of judgment. And we continually face that. We continually face that. And different people have different standards. And those standards change over time. So you may, but it's a question, it's that old-fashioned thing, judgment. At the end of the day, there are no rules. You know, you can lay down a question of judgment. And frankly, we make mistakes. Every day we make mistakes. But I think we make more good decisions than bad decisions. You know, have we made mistakes in the past? Yes. Will we continue to make mistakes? Yes, it's very difficult. In complex, you know, we operate in 110 countries. And, you know, in each of those countries, there are different attitudes to the sort of issues that you're talking about. I was on a panel, I moderated a panel in South Korea last week, on which Megawati, who was the former Prime Minister of Indonesia, President of Indonesia, was sitting next to Colin Powell, and she was very much against the Iraq war. So you find these differences, and as a company has become more globalized, it becomes much more difficult to come to terms with them.
So Martin, I certainly appreciate your insights and your optimism, which is pleasant.
Optimism about America. Yeah,
that's correct. I mean, that's pleasant to us here. We're so pleased you can take time out of
your... I
did
that because I knew that would resonate with the audience.
Branding. Well, thank you very much. We thank Sir Martin Sorrell.